Welcome to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science and innovation. We say at the heart because we feel like we are in the center of a powerful brain engine, changing what we know, how we live, what we do. Think about all of the inventions and discoveries that have come out of this region.
Nylon.
Hepatitis B vaccine.
First transplant surgery.
Dialysis machine.
Transistor.
Positive psychology.
Biomarker tests for Alzheimer's.
The first computer.
Cognitive therapy.
And more discoveries are happening at any moment. Join WHYY's health and science reporters on the beat.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
I'm Zach Seward.
And I'm Mike and Scott. On today's edition of The Pulse, a look at trials, clinical trials and tribulations, try and try again, the stuff of science and life. First up, a story about a trial that changed clinical trials. In the 1990s, a new treatment was getting a lot of hype as a cure-all for devastating diseases. Human gene therapy.
It was the next big thing.
Art Kaplan was the new medical ethicist at the University of Pennsylvania, one of the main research hubs for this approach. Kaplan met a young researcher named James Wilson, who ran Penn's Institute for Human Gene Therapy.
I went to some talks. It turned out he was trying to find ways to repair gene defects, broken genes in people that were leading to terrible diseases. He thought if he could engineer a virus to carry, let's say, specially designed DNA to fix what was wrong in the human DNA, say for cystic fibrosis, muscular dystrophy, maybe you could actually repair the cells in people who had these diseases and restore them to health.
Kaplan says James Wilson and his research team honed in on OTC. That's a rare metabolic disorder, and it affects the body's ability to get rid of ammonia. It can be deadly, especially for babies. After conducting animal studies, the team decided to test the gene therapy in adults with a mild form of OTC.
That's how they got to Jesse Gelsinger, one of the most famous names in all of clinical trials today.
Jesse Gelsinger was 18 years old and volunteered to be part of the study. Now, this trial was not going to cure the disease in him. It was merely meant to save babies with OTC, to allow them to survive long enough to get on a special diet.
This was a clinical trial that ended in disaster. Jesse Gelsinger died.
Huge backlash followed.
Some things came out. Jim Wilson had, and University of Pennsylvania, had an economic interest in a company that was commercializing the production of these gene therapy viruses. Was that right? Should anybody own what they're studying? Conflict of interest became a big issue in clinical trials as a result of the death of Jesse Gelsinger. There were signals in the trials with animals that maybe there were problems with the virus. Wilson and his group had thought they'd adjusted. But others said, boy, you should have not gone so fast. Was there too much ambition, too much pressure, too much optimism because people got caught up in the hype of gene therapy? Did they get to human trials too fast? Even today, when somebody says, let's try out a new treatment and we want to get into human trials, I hear all the time the echo of the death of Jesse Gelsinger because people say, we can only go, say, three subjects at a time, and we want to stop and see what's going on.
What changed in terms of informed consent?
So another issue that came up was, did Jesse Gelsinger and others who were in the study, did they really understand the risks? Did they know they could die? And a lot of people said the informed consent wasn't good enough. It hadn't mentioned the animal signals that there might be problems with gene therapy. Did it really lay out clearly the risks? And I think people redoubled their efforts to make sure clearly on the first trials in humans that it says about as loudly as you can, no benefit expected. This is a safety study.
Many things have changed since this trial. Are we better off?
We've done better on conflict of interest. Researchers know they should not own stock or equity or stand to profit directly from what they study. The disclosures that people get on informed consent, I'm not sure how effective they are because most people are going to say, doc, if you think this is the right thing for me, then I don't care if you own the company or you made it in your garage or you're going to make $1 million. They trust. that their doctor is going to make that recommendation. I'm not sure they read that consent form. One other interesting lesson, I think, is that clinical trials have gotten harder to do because there's a lot more regulation, a lot more paperwork, a lot more oversight. And I do worry that it's raised the cost of doing clinical trials because you have to, lawyers have to look at it, and ethicists are running around, and committees are looking at the consent forms. While I'm not against all of that, we have to come up with ways to streamline it and make it more efficient.
I was going to ask you, can we weigh the people we save by doing things right against the people we are losing because we're not finding things and we're not curing cancer and doing all those great things?
So from my point of view, what we wind up seeing in clinical trials is a pendulum. People yell to go faster. My daughter has a brain tumor that there's no answer to. Let's get a clinical trial. If it worked in a mouse, then put it in her, and she doesn't have a lot of time to wait, and let's go. And then someone dies. And there is a rush to say, how could that happen? And how could we accept the idea that there's risk, and not only risk, but death? So I would say, I think we're too risk-averse. I think we're kidding ourselves that we can regulate and have enough oversight to take all risk out of research. I do worry that some people aren't getting benefited as fast as they might because the paperwork is slow, or some people say, I'm not going into clinical trial work. It's too bureaucratic. I don't need to be second-guessed all day. That bothers me, and I worry that we're slowed down because of that in terms of making progress.
That's medical ethicist Art Kaplan, who was at the University of Pennsylvania when Jesse Gelsinger died in 1999. Jesse's father sued the university. Art Kaplan was first named in the lawsuit, but later dropped from it. And for gene therapy, the trials weren't over yet. In another nightmare scenario, children receiving gene therapy in France developed leukemia as a terrible side effect of the treatment. But in 2008, the field scored a major victory at the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, where scientists treated a boy who had a genetic disease causing blindness. Science writer Ricky Lewis describes this in her new book, The Forever Fix, Gene Therapy and the Boy Who Saved It.
8-year-old Corey Haas, 4 days after his gene therapy, he and his parents went to visit the Philadelphia Zoo. And at that time, there's this huge hot air balloon over the zoo. It has a big tiger painted on it. And when Corey and his parents walked up to the zoo entrance, Corey heard the other kids screaming about the balloon, so he instinctively looked up and he screamed because it was the first time that he'd ever seen the sun. And it was only 4 days after the gene therapy. And when I heard that, it gave me the chills because Jesse Gelsinger had been treated in the same city, also in September, 9 years earlier. And 4 days after his gene therapy, he passed away. So it was a tremendous renaissance for the field.
The European Union recently approved a gene therapy drug for sale. It treats a rare metabolic disease, and that's a huge milestone for this field. Ricky Lewis says gene therapy's time has finally come. You're listening to The Pulse on WHYY, and our show today is about trials. Sometimes the most trying period in finding a treatment is not during the clinical trials, but things get tricky later in the game. Tanya English is here. Hi, Tanya.
Hey, Maiken.
And Tanya, you're going to tell us about a vaccine that has really faced an uphill battle.
Right. So it's the vaccine designed to protect against the human papillomavirus. HPV can cause unsightly genital warts, and in a small percentage of cases, when the virus lingers, it can lead to cancer of the cervix. It's the most common sexually transmitted infection in the United States, but only about 50% of girls have started the vaccine. Public health experts have had a tough time convincing some parents that, number one, that the vaccine is safe, and number two, that the shots should be one of the routine immunizations for preteen kids. Michelle Bachmann even brought it up during the presidential campaign. Maybe you remember this.
To have innocent little 12-year-old girls be forced to have a government injection through an executive order is just flat out wrong.
Between the mandate debates, between the sex issues, the way it was rolled out, it got caught up in politics. It had a really, really rough start.
That's Amy Leader. She's a health researcher at Thomas Jefferson University's Kimmel Cancer Center. She says the debate over the HPV vaccine has been raging for 6 years. It works best if children get the vaccine long before sexual contact. So the shots are recommended for children age 11 or 12.
The age has been, let's just call it problematic rather than a problem.
Pertussis and tetanus vaccines are also recommended for adolescents. But whooping cough and lockjaw are not spread through sex. Some parents and doctors are uncomfortable starting a conversation about a vaccine for a sexually transmitted disease when a child may not have hit puberty yet.
The doc would say, I just got a sense from mom that we didn't want to go there yet.
Looking for a solution, health investigators in Philadelphia took HPV education directly to families. The team answered questions and reminded moms that cervical cancer kills. And it turns out those families were more likely to get the shots. Despite those findings, Leader says the way the health system sells the vaccine to moms and dads hasn't really changed.
Who knows? It gets caught up in all sorts of all these other things in public health that we have to worry about, and obesity and asthma and diabetes and healthy lunches. And, you know, the list goes on and on in public health. So
money's tight for health officials, but drug maker Merck invested big in a marketing campaign for its vaccine, Gardasil.
Gardasil. Gardasil. Gardasil.
With Gardasil, you could be one less.
G-L-E-S-S. I want to be one less, one less.
Leader asked girls in her study about the ads.
They knew the commercials. They recognized them. They could sing the jingle. They knew all about that. And then I said, okay, what's the message? What's the health topic here? Silence.
I don't think just a quick commercial is going to do it. There's too many other factors that go along with it that you kind of just can't gloss over.
That's Jillian Lucas-Baker. She's a prevention researcher at LaSalle University. She says even administering the vaccine is complicated. The vaccine requires 2 follow-up shots, and parents forget to come back. To add another wrinkle, Baker says early on, there was this concern.
Okay, well, if I get my daughter vaccinated for HPV, am I then saying it's okay to have sex? We're going to have that conversation, you know? So it's scary.
Research released earlier this year dismisses the idea that girls who get vaccinated are more likely to be sexually active. But when sex wasn't the issue, parents were concerned about safety. There are whole websites dedicated to stories like this one posted on YouTube.
In 2007, I was scared into taking the Gardasil shot. In June, I had my first shot right after my 21st birthday. When I took the second one, I lost the ability to walk. I started falling down.
Public health experts counter that anecdotal reports are not the same as research. Christopher Chambers is a family doctor in Philadelphia. He's a longtime HPV vaccine researcher at Thomas Jefferson and has gotten funding from the drug makers.
Yes, there are going to be people who have developed medical problems sometime in relationship to when they got a vaccine. We know that things can happen. A person can get a shot and then a vaccine and then the next day get hit by a SEPTA bus, but we wouldn't say the vaccine had anything to do with it.
Chambers says the HPV vaccine is as safe as other routine vaccines for kids in the same age group. In his conversations with parents, Chambers talks about his own sons.
Particularly for the boys, you know, where there's, I think, less public discussion about the vaccine. It's very helpful for them to know that this is something I endorse for my own kids.
Health officials only added boys to the recommendation about a year ago. When certain HPV strains become chronic in the body, infection can lead to anal or oral cancer. Chambers used a medical journal article recently about genital warts to drive home that message to his son.
I said, hey, Rex, come over here and take a look at this picture. And he said, oh, my God, Dad, you didn't have to show me that.
Chambers says actually he doesn't get much pushback from parents when he offers the vaccine to longtime patients. A recommendation from a trusted doctor convinced Bucks County mom Irene Pontarelli and her daughter.
Just talking to my daughter's pediatrician, she said, I want you to make up your mind, but my recommendation is that she get it. Because I trust my pediatrician, I felt good about the decision.
A long-time relationship was missing for Karen Cherubini. She and her kid's new doctor were just getting to know each other when the pediatrician suggested that Cherubini's son get the HPV shot that day.
I was not even close to ready, and I was completely thrown off.
Cherubini is a science teacher and lives in Philadelphia near the Art Museum.
I had no expectation that my son would need it, first of all, and second of all, at age 11. he's not sexually active. He's not there yet. Thank goodness. You know, a sexually active teenager is a much different parenting scenario than where I've been. And so this is definitely new territory. And in learning more, I have realized that this is one I'm going to have to trust the experts on.
Health researcher Amy Leader says lots of parents are still on the fence.
We're hitting this from all these different angles. I don't know what else needs to be tried. It's a government-recommended vaccine. It's rolled into the regular schedule. We're educating parents, providers, systems. I think we just have to keep working on it.
Tanya, this story really illustrates that sometimes when the clinical trials are over, the real trial has just begun to get people to accept the product.
It's true. You know, and it shows up just one more tension. It's the tension between the job that public health people have to do and the jobs that moms and dads have to do. Kind of thinking about the needs and health access and risks for a particular child versus a whole population. HPV is a very common infection. It usually goes away on its own most times, but when it doesn't, it can lead to a deadly cancer.
And that's what the public health officials have to keep in mind.
Exactly.
Thank you, Tanya.
Thank you.
Coming up on The Pulse, are researchers inadvertently fudging the numbers in studies?
You could argue that we found the fountain of youth. All you have to do is listen to this song about old age and it makes you younger. So obviously that's not true.
Also, a look at residency, the ultimate trial on the journey to become a doctor.
I ended up in the hospital for 2 straight weeks, sleeping in an ICU bed next to a patient.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse on WHYY. Welcome back to The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Today's show is about trials, and joining us now in the studio is Carolyn Beeler. Hi, Carolyn.
Hi, Mike. And so you're right. Obviously, this is all about trials, so I wanted to do a little trial right here in the studio, a little experiment. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Okay, I want you to listen to this song and tell me how you feel afterward.
When I get older, losing my head, many years from now, will you still be sending me a valentine? Birthday greetings, bottle of wine.
All right, how do you feel? Do you feel younger?
No. Why would I feel younger?
Well, because that song, When I'm 64 by the Beatles, has been proven to make people almost a year and a half younger.
Hold on. Make them younger or make them feel younger?
Make them younger. That was proven in a study that found that listening to the song had a statistically significant impact on age. Joe Simmons is one of the University of Pennsylvania researchers who published the study.
You could argue that we found the fountain of youth. All you have to do is listen to the song about old age and it makes you younger. So obviously that's not true.
Totally bogus. The group that listened to the song just happened to be younger than the group they compared them to, but Simmons manipulated the data to make it appear that the song was actually causing the age difference.
And for what reason?
That's a good question. The point was to show how statistical techniques can end up being misused to skew data, even when researchers are trying to do everything by the book. When the paper was published about a year ago, it made a big splash, and it's become part of a much larger conversation about whether poor research methods have led to lots of false findings in psychology, medicine, and other fields.
So this When I'm 64 study, how did they do it?
So the data gathering part of the study was fine, totally kosher. The researchers recruited some undergraduates to sit in a computer lab.
And you would listen to a song, and the song would either be When I'm 64 by the Beatles, or it would be a song called Kalimba, which comes free with the Windows 7 operating system. And then after that, you would answer a battery of questions, and then we collect the data and analyze it.
And that's where Simmons started massaging the numbers.
And we did that in a number of ways. So one of the things we did, I told you that you either listen to Kalimba or you listen to When I'm 64, but I omitted the fact that there was a third condition of participants who listened to a song by the Wiggles called Hot Potato.
Here's a taste of that tune for you.
Hot potato, hot potato. Hot potato, hot potato.
But why does that matter? Is just playing an extra song, is that what got them to this crazy result?
No, that was just one of the many things in Simmons' bag of tricks.
How does Hot Potato play into it, though?
Well, I'll get back to that in just a second, but first I need to explain something called a p-value because this whole thing sort of hinges on it. The p-value is a measurement that's used to answer this question. If a researcher sees a difference between two test groups in an experiment, was that difference due to the treatment applied to one group, so in this case when I'm 64, or was it just due to chance?
All right, so there has to be some way to prove that it's the drug or the treatment causing the change and not just coincidence.
Exactly, and for a lot of scientific studies, that's the p-value. Ed Gracely is a biostats professor from Drexel, and he explained to me how it's used.
Suppose in truth there was no difference. In fact, it's all just random. How likely would we have been to get a difference as good as we got or better purely by chance? Well, what we do is we calculate a probability for that, and that's the statistical p-value. And we set our criterion for calling it statistically significant if that p-value is 0.05 or 5% or less.
So if the p-value is 5% or less, scientists consider the difference they're seeing statistically significant. 5% is just the value scientists decided they could live with at some point.
So what we're saying is 5% of the time, even when there really is no effect, we would declare statistical significance.
That's basically an error rate of 5%. 5 times out of 100, your statistically significant finding isn't actually statistically significant. It's a false positive. The only problem with that...
5% of the time happens 5% of the time.
So if you run 20 different analyses, odds are one is going to be found, quote, statistically significant purely by chance, which is why it's bad practice to run extra experiments like making people listen to Hot Potato and then not report them because your readers, the people looking at the study, don't know you had that extra hypothesis and then the higher possible false positive rates that would go along with it.
Back to my question about the Hot Potato song, just that one extra variable made this whole thing work then?
No, this is where the rest of Simmons' bag of tricks comes in. When he had his undergraduates come into the computer lab, he also asked them a bunch of other questions, like their mother's age, their father's age, whether they would go to an early bird special.
What?
Yeah, pretty ridiculous stuff in this example. Then he sliced and diced the data. He ran the statistical significant test lots of times, comparing lots of different things, holding different things constant, until he landed on something significant.
That sounds like total nonsense, though.
Right. I thought so, too. So I asked Joe Simmons if what he'd done would get through a peer review for a journal.
We would hope that in the review process, if this paper actually went under an actual review process, they would be asking the hard questions that you're asking right now. But it's not a given.
So, really?
Yeah, it's not a given. I mean, when you are given papers to review, you're busy. And you don't always question every finding, especially if everything else looks good.
Carolyn, do researchers do this kind of thing on purpose?
Most people say no. I mean, there is a slight bias toward things that are going to give you a statistically significant finding. But Simmons is arguing most researchers just don't know that these things have as big of an impact on the end result as they actually do. Still, he says his example took the number fudging way over the top to make a point as to how much this is actually happening.
Different people in our field have strongly different opinions about how common these various things are.
Even lacking a consensus, there's been a lot more attention on this issue recently. An anonymous survey done this year of more than 2,000 research psychologists found, though caveat here, the results are relatively controversial, that some of these questionable research practices are actually pretty common. For example,
only report the measures that work, only report the conditions that work.
About half of respondents surveyed said they'd done that.
As you're collecting your sample sizes, you're analyzing the data and then stopping when it becomes significant.
That's kind of like closing the polls when your candidate is ahead in an election, and 1 in 7 respondents had done that. Now, reformers have emerged in different fields. Perhaps most notably is a Stanford doctor named John E. Ioannidis. He wrote a paper several years ago with the rather startling title, Why Most Published Research Findings Are False, and it's still pretty widely cited.
Oh, is he the one who talked about vitamin E to reduce the risk of heart disease, that actually doesn't work?
Right, that's the guy. Because of him and others like him, there are now conversations about how to fix this. I talked about this with Dr. David Chen, who's a Fox Chase surgical oncologist who reviews articles for urology journals.
I think that historically, if somebody had some outstanding, exciting breakthrough, usually journals did not question much about that data.
Chen says that's changing.
Now they are much more demanding that not only are results published, but access to the data is available for review.
Next month, the British Medical Journal will no longer publish the results of clinical trials unless drug companies agree to provide detailed study data. The journal Psychological Science is doing something similar, voluntarily at least for now. Its editor, Eric Ike, says other groups are also systematically trying to reproduce past experiments to see if they replicate.
Most research in psychology or pretty well any other field, it's all geared toward discovery. People get kudos for discovering new things. It tends to be undervalued trying to replicate somebody else's findings.
Carolyn, it sounds like the academics are working on this. In the meantime, what do we do as consumers? I just saw a new study saying that salt isn't bad for you after all, and I really want to believe that.
Well, I think in all things, a healthy skepticism is key. Realize that one study is almost never the definitive word on anything. You need to look at the whole body of research. And there's, you know, very rarely a silver bullet when it comes to health. And there are other things that regular people can look out for in news reports and in medical literature to see how valid it is. And we have some of those pointers on our website, newsworks.org.
Thank you, Carolyn.
Thanks, Mikan.
When I'm 64.
Entire volumes of statistically significant studies have shown that interacting with the healthcare system can be pretty annoying. Our team is covering this issue in an occasional investigative series called Pain in the Neck.
Tests, more tests, and more tests.
Referrals.
Huge bills.
I don't like dealing with co-pays.
Pain in the neck.
Ooh, it hurts. It hurts.
For this segment, we ask our listeners, what's the most annoying thing about our healthcare system? And is anybody trying to fix it? This week's submission for Pain in the Neck comes from Philadelphian Kathy Weiss.
The endless voicemail system.
To make, change, or cancel an appointment, please press 2.
So many options that you can lose your way and 10 minutes later be no closer to a resolution for your problem or an answer to your need than you were when you started.
To contact medical records, press 5. For all billing questions, press 6.
It's really primitive and, you know, it is dysfunctional.
That's Vijay Khanna. He is the CEO of Concierge MD. And here's his right-hand man, Vince Barrett.
Healthcare is really not one technology generation behind, but two. Everybody else is already on mobile. And healthcare is just barely embracing the internet.
Concierge MD is a Newtown Square startup, and Vijay and Vince are trying to propel physicians into the age of modern communication.
Concierge MD is a patient engagement platform. People want better access in general, and that means easy, more convenient communication, two-way. They want to more easily schedule appointments. I mean, in this day and age, we rely on the internet to do so many different things. And yet in healthcare, we still have to do most of it face-to-face or by phone.
Please continue to hold. Your time is important to us, so please press 1.
Technology can enable instantaneous communication. So there's obviously the possibility of chat and even what we call e-visits, which is online communication, video, audio, right there on the spot.
The doctors are getting now paid more and more from the insurance companies based on performance. Doctors care about extending their arms. They want to make sure that the patient is participating in the betterment of their care.
Doctors want more free time, not less free time. You know, there is this perception that it's going to create more work for them. But as they get into it, they start to realize that their patients and their patients' caregivers are much more comfortable using these more modern forms of communication, and they can find them to be much more productive for them as well. So ultimately, they win back time.
Product has released. The initial feedback that we are getting is very, very positive.
The technology bit is pretty easy. It's getting people to understand the financial benefits or the value, if you will, in embracing it.
Vijay Khanna and Vince Barrett of Concierge MD. They predict we'll see huge changes in doctor-patient communication in the next few years. Do you have a submission for our Pain in the Neck segment? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org or tweet using hashtag WHYYPulse.
We're talking about trials today on The Pulse, and residency has been described as the ultimate, the final trial in medical training. Ask any older doctor to recall their residency training, and you'll hear stories like this one.
I ended up in the hospital for 2 straight weeks, sleeping in an ICU bed next to a patient.
That's Dr. David Paskin from Jefferson University Hospital.
Prior to starting that, I happened to go to a clothing store to buy a couple of new suits. They fitted me and they said, you know, the suits will be ready in a couple of weeks. Come back for them. So after these couple of weeks, I went to pick up my suits. And the man at the store said, will you please try the suits on? And I did. And he says, oh, my God, who fitted you for these suits? And they were hanging on me. I lost 15 pounds in those 2 weeks.
Like most former residents, Paskin clocked well over 100 hours each week. But residency isn't quite as grueling anymore. The rules were changed, first in 2003 and then again in 2011, capping work hours per week at 80 and limiting the amounts of hours per hospital shift. Now, this came as part of a broader effort to reduce medical errors. The thinking was that exhausted, overworked, and fairly inexperienced doctors were more likely to make mistakes. Some doctors are concerned about these changes. For example, Philadelphia physician Erin Lockhart, who completed her residency 6 years ago.
I'm concerned that residents are going to come out of residency having done like 1,000 hours less per year of training than even I did.
David Paskin, the doctor who lost 15 pounds, he's in charge of residents at Jefferson. And he says when the Accreditation Council for Graduate Medical Education came out with the new guidelines, they were not popular.
No one bought it. No one wanted it. Everyone thought it was, you know, something that was absolutely inappropriate. And who were they to tell us what to do?
But he had to implement them and eventually became a believer.
So I was the sort of the one, you know, telling people if you don't work 900 hours a week, you're not doing your job. To then be the bearer of the new truth and saying you got to let these residents go home.
How are today's residents experiencing their training? Do they feel ready and prepared? I spoke with Dr. Ellen Plum,
resident from the Department of Family and Community Medicine at Jefferson,
and Dr. Kanani Titchin.
Finished medical school at Jefferson here in Philadelphia in 2012, and now I'm in the first year of my residency in pediatrics.
They say residency is and remains a rite of passage, a trial, a time of many adjustments.
That period in your life where you're doing your residency training is extraordinarily intense. And I think that, you know, if you meet another physician on the street or anything, you have a shared experience. You know that what that other person experienced.
I think the biggest adjustment for me was realizing I'm no longer the medical school student. I'm no longer the bottom of the totem pole. And in fact, when I walk into a room and the nurses say, doctor, this patient is in crisis, what do you want to do? That they're talking to me. At first, I found myself looking over my shoulder for the doctor in the room, and then I realized, oh, they mean me.
And work restrictions or not, they are still putting in plenty of hours. Here's Kanani.
I mean, when you think about it, it's still pretty ludicrous that our restriction is that we can work twice as much as a normal, quote-unquote, normal job, 9-to-5 job. So I think an 80-hour restriction on the work week is a positive, although the 80 hours only includes the scheduled patient time. There's a lot of time spent doing charting, documenting things, research.
And how much can you really learn after having worked a 24-hour shift? Ellen.
I mean, I was exhausted. And so it was much harder to think. I was a little bit clumsy after 24 hours. I would notice that walking around the hospital that I felt a little off.
Both feel that even with the work hour restrictions, they will be fully prepared for their next job once this phase is over.
I do think that we are gaining the experience that we need, and we are also allowed to have a little bit more time for ourselves. We're getting a little bit more sleep, and I think that it is probably in the end having a more positive impact on our learning during this experience because, you know, it's very difficult to learn and very difficult to take care of patients in the best way that you can when you're completely exhausted emotionally, physically.
It protects my time outside of work. It also protects my time to do research, to read, to study, which is what I should be doing as a resident. That doesn't stop with medical school.
Dr. David Paskin is not entirely convinced. He buys into capping the total hours of work each week at 80. He's not happy about the restrictions that limit the consecutive hours a resident can be in the hospital to 16 in the first year and 24 in subsequent years.
We may have swung a little too far to the, not the soft side, but the exposure side may not be enough for the resident to really get a full flavor of what it's like to take care of a patient with continuity of an illness in a hospital. Now that we've sort of played in this arena for a decade, really, I think it's time for us to look at everything and try to look at data, because a lot of these decisions were made without data. They were made on, well, we think this should be because. Well, that's not really what you call basing decisions on evidence.
So maybe, says Paskin, it's time to rewrite the rules once again.
It's our job to do, I think, now as the educators, is to try to figure out what's good and what's not good and try to put a package together that we have a program which benefits the patient, benefits the resident, but doesn't deprive them or doesn't let us send residents out there supposedly fully trained, taking care of patients when they're really not. And am I concerned? Sure I am, because guess what? I'm going to be one of those patients.
And so will we, Dr. Paskin. So will we. Check out pictures and more info at newsworks.org/thepulse. Have a residency horror story or some input on this story? Tweet using hashtag WHYYPulse. Coming up on The Pulse, everybody says it's a lost cause, but a local inventor continues to try.
We put the voltage up to about something like that.
I'm Mike and Scott, and this is The Pulse. I'm Mike and Scott. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. Today's show is about trials, and trials typically include long periods of trying. It's what fuels scientific discovery, people who try and try and try until they discover something, find something. This happens at corporate research and development, at universities, and sometimes in basement workshops. Zach Seward is here. Hey, Zach.
Hey, Mike.
And you're going to take us to one such basement.
That's right. So I found a Philadelphia inventor. He's working on the fringes of physics.
So what's his story?
Well, it's basically a story of a guy who says he's onto something.
Yeah, Fran McCabe, and I am a somewhat screwball inventor, but I'm trying to give up the screwball side of things.
What's his background?
He studied mechanical engineering at Drexel, but dropped out. Then he flew planes in the Navy. Then he started a fire control business in the late 60s.
You would pressurize the non-fire zones, and you would depressurize the fire zones. I patented all the equipment that it takes to do that kind of stuff.
So he's been successful, but he's not an established scientist?
Right. No PhD, no master's, no nothing. He'll be the first to tell you that. But definitely a smart guy, you know, a successful entrepreneur, a maker, a doer. His work on airfoils helped start this small wind turbine company in Bucks County a few years ago. In all, he's got about 100 patents to his name, actually.
So what's he working on these days?
Well, his passion is gyroscopes.
Gyroscopes.
Yeah, you know, maybe you've played with them as a kid. They kind of look like globes that rotate and spin around an axis. And they do these things that seem kind of unreal. I mean, they also do actual things. They're really good at keeping a steady orientation. So they're mostly used for navigation, everything from cruise ships to space shuttles. But McCabe's gyroscopes are all about power and motion. He thinks they can be an energy game changer.
We put the voltage up to about something like that. And now this starts to precess.
You can hear the sparks flying there. What's going on?
Yeah, that's just one of the many homemade machines in McCabe's basement. He lives in the Mount Airy neighborhood of Philadelphia, and his devices all do similar but different things. harnessing gyroscopes to do stuff.
NASA is looking at this principle.
Some might be able to launch something really fast. Some make compressed air for powering things. He's working on a bunch of stuff. But the thing he sees the most potential in is what he calls a dynamo.
Where is he taking us?
Okay, we're going out behind the garage, and there's this dynamo thing, which is basically a big metal disc hanging kind of like a tire swing. It's about 3 feet across, mounted on an axle at the center of the disc, which is attached to the wooden patio above.
This has 1.2, it's a real small motor.
That motor gets the contraption spinning, and a quick shove gets it rotating off the ground. McCabe says the dynamo puts out way more energy than he puts in.
So once this thing's spinning, you could then ultimately, you're saying power a house if you could do it.
That's what I'm trying to do, but this won't do it because this is working just to handle its own weight. Now what you got to do is trick this thing out of handling its own weight and make it do work.
He still has to figure that part out, but here's the kicker with McCabe's devices so far. He says they can output as much as 1,000 times the energy you put in.
That sounds amazing, but where's the but?
Sounds cool, yeah, but according to physics, it's also entirely impossible.
Science is a delicate balance between bold conjectures and then the hard-headed skepticism that tests it against.
So that's Donald Simonic. He's an emeritus professor of physics at Lock Haven University in Pennsylvania.
In every mechanism that has ever been made, the energy is strictly conserved. You never get out more than you put in.
Simonic is also the founder of the Museum of Unworkable Devices. It's a website, actually, of inventions that are just too good to be true.
Is that where we're going to find McCabe's dynamo?
It would definitely qualify, because it's an over-unity device, and unity is this principle where you can only ever get, at best, a one-to-one ratio of input to output. Now, remember how McCabe says his device just trounces that ratio? That's the same idea behind perpetual motion machines.
Because you could use some of that excess energy and feed it into the input, and you'd have a machine that's producing energy without any external input at all. Wouldn't that be great? But nature doesn't work that way.
So Simonic definitely thinks this is never going to work. What do you think?
Well, it's cool stuff, and I'd like to believe in it, but all evidence suggests it just can't work. Most folks would call it pseudoscience. McCabe would say, with gyroscopes, you get something totally different from the norm. They behave in different ways and aren't fully understood. Simonic, on the other hand, would say he's just made a mistake in his calculations and that McCabe is just the latest in a long line of inventors captivated by this bogus idea of free energy or perpetual motion machines.
But even if McCabe never finds what he's looking for, isn't there value in the quest, in the continuous trying and pushing the boundaries?
Yeah, you could see it that way. I mean, there's all these famous sort of accidental inventions from penicillin to Teflon, all sorts of stuff that was sort of found along the way. You know, even now there's whole societies of people doing peer-reviewed science on subjects that are far outside the mainstream. But on the other hand, there's whole societies of skeptics who say these scientists and inventors should stick to what they call the realm of the possible.
The thing that fascinated me, though, about McCabe is that he just continues to try, even though everybody says it's not going to work. Why? Why does he continue?
I mean, it's pretty much the same motivation many scientists feel. The idea is that a new invention can benefit mankind. It's something that McCabe agrees with, but I did ask him about it.
Like, what's the goal? What's the point when you're doing stuff like this?
Well, when you get into something that you have this gift, like, whether you want to say from God, aliens, or whatever you think about those kind of things, that you have this intuition. And people have it. It's abundant. Everybody has it. Some people use it, polish it off a little bit, but you intuit that there's something better than what is out there.
And that's the point of contention, whether there's room for this raw intuition in science. Most would say no, but some are always going to keep saying yes.
Thank you, Zach.
Thank you, Mikey.
And now it's time to play a little game we call...
So, what do you do?
For this game, we team up a layperson with one of the region's many researchers and scientists.
Hi, Jonathan Singer.
Hello, Frank Rocker from the Wistar Institute.
Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too.
Jonathan Singer teaches social work at Temple University. He asked cancer researcher Frank Rauscher,
"What do you do?"
We're interested in finding genes, the genetic cause of cancer. Which ones are they? What they do? And how we can use those to create new therapies for cancer, which are actually tailored exactly to the cancer that you have. And therefore, these drugs will only then attack the cancer that have an altered gene product. That's the goal.
So what's the coolest thing that you've learned about cancer cells or these genes in your research?
You know, Jonathan, I think the coolest thing that I've learned is that it's now, with the advent of the genomic age, that it's a very confined problem. Out of the 38,000 genes in our human genome, only a handful, maybe a couple hundred, cause cancer when they're mutated. When you get the problem down to that manageable set of genes and a network of those genes, you can target it very well. This is something that's come about in the last 10 years, and we've been studying cancer for 100 years.
So do you think that cancer treatment's going to be different in 20 years from now?
Absolutely. It will be different 5 to 10 years from now. Every person that walks through the door of a clinic and thinks they have a tumor will have their tumor and their normal DNA genotyped, as we say. We'll know exactly what genes you inherited. We'll know exactly which genes were mutated in your tumor. We are going towards personalized, individualized cancer therapeutics.
So I come in, I think I've got cancer, and you do a little biopsy kind of thing, and then suddenly it's like the Jonathan drug?
There'll be possibly a mixture of drugs that target different aspects of what your tumor is doing. And what an oncogeneticist will do is take a sample of your blood, take a sample of your tumor like they do now. They'll also look at it under the microscope. And between those sets of data, they'll be able to say, you're going to respond to XXX drug. And that's what we're going to give you. Not like now, where every lung cancer patient that comes through the door gets the exact same thing. And all you're hoping is that they kill the cancer faster than the normal cell.
I mean, this sounds so science fiction-y, right? Like, this is the promise that all the drug companies are making. Like, is this really going to happen? Like, what do you see as being the big barrier to this actually happening?
That's a very good question. So remarkably and surprisingly to some extent, the big barrier is analysis of the data. Imagine, 50 patients come to UPenn or Wistar every day, sequencing your genome and the tumor's genome and interrogating that. So the big field coming forward is bioinformatics, how to reduce that data down, interpret it in time for you to get the proper therapy the next week or two. The bottleneck is the data analysis.
So when are we going to see this?
It is being rolled out now, pretty much. But again, we have to solve problems of the data acquisition, integrating this data, and utilizing it in a manner that it can be disseminated to everyone. And we haven't solved that problem yet. But it's very clear now that if we can identify these mutations and simply combine maybe two or three types of therapy directed at them, it can be curative. This is not fairy tale stuff. It is happening now. Just this year, new therapies for malignant melanoma were approved after a very short time at the FDA. These are now frontline therapies for melanoma, which cure people.
This was amazing. Thank you so much for answering all my questions. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Jonathan. It was wonderful to be here.
Want to be part of an interview on So What Do You Do? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org. And that's also where you can send us email about this show, because The Pulse itself is still in its trial phase and we need to hear from you. Tell us what you liked, what you didn't like, or what we could cover. On today's show, we heard about fudging the numbers in studies, a vaccine with a serious PR problem, and an inventor who thinks he can create energy, just to mention a few stories. And you can hear any segment or the whole show again at newsworks.org/thepulse. Our engineers for The Pulse were Bob Alls, Al Banks, and Kevin Griffin. Christine Dempsey and Chris Atulu are our project managers. Special thanks to Elizabeth Perez-Luna. Todd Vachon is our web producer. The segments on The Pulse are produced by our health and science team, Tanya English, Carolyn Beeler, and Zach Seward. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.